Good evening. You're listening to Fourth Estate, the show where journalists talk journalism. Coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. I'm Evangeline Maguire and my quietly awesome producer tonight is Roderick Chambers. Coming up on the show... According to a study set to be published in the International Journal of Press/Politics, male political journalists based in Washington, D.C. only reply 8.5% of the time to female political journalists on the Beltway Twitter platform. According to the study, male political journalists retweet and reply 91.5% of other male journalists, and women have far fewer followers than men. So why is it that female journalists are less influential on the Twitter platform in Washington, D.C. than men, and does this relate to a bigger picture? Is this a situation that we see here in Australia? I'm sure this will make for a lively debate tonight. Also coming up on the show, White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders was politely asked to leave the Red Hen restaurant in Lexington, Virginia, by the owner of the shop, Stephanie Wilkinson, who claimed that she disagreed with Ms. Sanders' work for an inhumane and unethical administration. The president himself became riled up in the fine dining controversy and tweeted a fiery statement, claiming that the restaurant was filthy and in need of a paint job. Quote, "I always had a rule. If a restaurant is dirty on the outside, it is dirty on the inside." As bizarre as this situation is to us in Australia, the whole situation has sparked a debate over civility, political protest, and how Trump administration officials should really be treated in the public. We will also have time to cover the ABC saga with the government and Natalie Joyce's tell-all interview with the Australian Woman's Weekly. Helping me dissect this fractured media world is in the studio Tamara Wern, state political reporter of 2GB and former 2SER newsreader. Hi, Tamara. Welcome back to the station.
Good evening. Thank you.
Lauren Carroll Harris, Sydney-based freelance journalist contributing to The Guardian and ABC's Radio National. Hi, Lauren.
Hey, how's it going?
And we have Benedict Brook, national affairs reporter at news.com.au. Welcome, Benedict.
Thanks for having me.
Who knew that this Twitter sphere has reportedly become so male? A study of American political reporters based in Washington, D.C. has found that male political journalists reply 91.5% of the time to male journalists on Twitter, suggesting that female journalists are struggling to make their voices heard in this Twitter echo chamber. The study looked at 2,292 Twitter accounts belonging to Washington, D.C.-based Beltway journalists and found that while there are only slightly more male than female reporters, men are far more likely to tweet more, retweet each other, and on average have twice as many followers. Now, I'll throw this one to you, Tamara. As a female political reporter who works in AM radio, do you feel like you are overshadowed by your male political journalists on Twitter?
Well, it's interesting because most of the parliamentary press gallery in New South Wales are actually female journalists rather than male. And generally, because there's so much competition between the different media outlets, we don't tend to retweet each other. We tend to like each other's stories, so it doesn't look like that my organisation is retweeting something from one of the major television programs or another radio station. So I think in state politics, at least in New South Wales, the situation is quite different. Most of the journos, we all get on quite well, and it's quite cordial. And there is a fierce competition when it comes to who gets what yarn, when, who has it first, and which sources you have. So as soon as someone tweets a breaking story, all of us are trying to figure out where they got it from and how it was done. So Twitter is generally used for us as a way to track and have conversations with each other. But I think this comparison probably works better with the Canberra Press Gallery because there are people who do have very high profiles on Twitter, journalists. So, for example, BuzzFeed journos tend to have a lot of conversation with their audience on Twitter as well, and other journos too. So I find there's a lot more conversation happening between journalists in the Canberra Press Gallery than there is between New South Wales journos. I also found with this, working in radio for me, I've got a file every hour, usually on multiple stories. So for me, if I can get something breaking out on Twitter, that's great. But my first priority is to get something in so it can run in the news. Otherwise, my boss won't be very happy. So for me, that's my priority, is getting something on air and doing live crosses, and Twitter then kind of comes after that. So it'd be interesting to see out of this survey how many journalists work for different platforms, and whether that also affects how they tweet and the timing of their tweets as well.
I mean, Benedict, you're a bloke and you're on Twitter. Have you looked at your tweets and retweets lately?
I have looked at my tweets, and this made me kind of focus my mind on it. And the last kind of conversation I engaged in, and to Tamara's point, I mean, who's got the time, right, to like have all these back and forth conversations?
Yeah.
But the last one I did was indeed a bloke. And then I was like, oh, okay, is this like some huge unconscious bias thing going on? Because the figures you that are quoting this are just amazing, was that like 91% or something? And then what was the figure for?
So 91.5% of males only reply to other male journalists, yeah. Which means that 8.5% of women are being heard on Twitter.
I mean, that's just bizarre, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's bizarre. But I was having a look at the biggest kind of political journos on Twitter here and seeing, you know, who their followers were, and I mean, not really the BuzzFeeds, but I guess more established media. But people like Peter Van Onselen, he's got 104,000 followers. Chris Yeoman, ABC, and now 944,000. Phil Currie, about 100,000. But when you actually look at some of the female journalists on Twitter, a lot of them actually have bigger reaches. Samantha Maiden of News Corp and Sky has 100,000. Lee Sales has 353,000 people. Annabelle Crabb has 500,000 people following her. So, the figures from Beltway DC don't seem to ring out necessarily over here.
That follows on to my next question, which was, you know, do you think that Australia would see this same problem as they are seeing in America in Washington, D.C.?
No, I'd be quite surprised if it was. I'm aware that I'm a man, so maybe I don't have a kind of full view on this. But from my viewpoint, I haven't seen this. I mean, I work in a newsroom where our two most senior members of staff are women. So from my point of view, I cannot imagine this happening here. But in you know, as you were talking about Canberra, I mean, you know, it's a different atmosphere down there. Who knows what's going on?
I mean, I'll put this to you, Lauren. What do you think? Do you think that there's a gendered problem on Twitter and that we might see that in Australia?
Well, I actually don't think that these study results are bizarre. I think that it would be bizarre for the world of journalism and the world of Twitter to not be as sexist as the world around it and the world that they've come from. Because there is an interpersonal dimension of how sexism manifests, and that's, you know, implicitly, I think that, you know, men tend to be respected as experts when they speak, and women are treated as kind of like over-opinionated hobbyists. And, you know, like the thing about Twitter is it's not just about followers, it's about your engagement and how you relate to people on there, like who you're commenting with and how they're engaging with you. And the really interesting thing about this study was it found that there was actually gender division on both sides. Women were often kind of retweeting other women a bit more, and maybe that's to compensate. But I think it does confirm something that we know, which is that you're quite siloed on social media. You tend to, you know, see your own worldview reflected back to you. But the new thing maybe that this shows is that it's gendered, like your gender silos are reinforced. And I think the reason that matters is because Twitter does actually have all this cultural power. It's where, as you were saying, Tamara, news is breaking and, you know, news is being discussed. And I think we actually need to stop talking about Twitter as a social media platform and as a news outlet, because, you know, the Twitter editors, they could address this quite easily. I think, you know, all the decisions they're making about, you know, what is profiled and highlighted as a Twitter moment, maybe they need to consider, you know, if they're reinforcing some of these gender silos. Or, for example, I don't know, there's probably any number of different things that could be done to kind of correct that.
Do you feel that you are marginalised on Twitter?
I'm not sure, maybe. I've never heard a male writer or journo be called opinionated, that's for sure, and that's something that gets lobbed at me. So I do think there are kind of unconscious biases and implicit forms of sexism that are manifesting online. So, yeah, I don't see this study as surprising at all, I'm afraid.
I mean, Tamara, do you agree? Do you have anything to add on to what Lauren's been saying?
I think in a sense it isn't surprising, as you said, there is sexism does exist in the world. It exists in Australia and it definitely exists in the workplace, and we've been having major discussions for decades now about pay inequality between men and women and differences in job opportunities and the like. For me personally, and I do think because of the prevalence that there are more women in state politics, and like Benedict has said, my news director and deputy news director are both women. So for me personally, in the organisation that I work in, I don't tend to find that imbalance per se. However, I mean, today as well, a tweet that I sent out about a job that I was at, one of the first people to like it was one of the biggest male journos in the gallery. So I personally don't find that myself in state, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. And I think that's the thing that we need to look at here. Even if we're not personally experiencing it, it doesn't mean that it doesn't happen.
That's right.
And it depends on what you're tweeting about as well, and who your followers are, who you're following. And I think that those gender silos that you mentioned before, Lauren, that we tend to follow people who are like us and who are interested in things that we're interested in. So there might be a natural pool there for us to follow people and like people who are of the same gender, who are of the same background, who are of the same political or social beliefs as us, because they reinforce what we're already thinking and believing. And with Facebook as well, you tend to be gravitated towards people who have opinions who validate your opinion or who confirm your social beliefs. So in a sense, I think that this, in a way, maybe goes beyond gender in that regard, because we're putting ourselves in all sorts of silos. But in terms of the numbers, I mean, they surprised me because of my personal experience at just how high they were, over 91%. But the findings in themselves weren't particularly, like the reasons behind the findings and why they thought that was the case wasn't very surprising.
You just got me thinking, actually. I remember on International Women's Day, Spotify had this plugin where you could analyse the musicians you'd been listening to by their gender, basically. And a lot of people were really surprised that they were mostly listening to male musicians, and they didn't think they were, because that's kind of how unconscious bias works. But it turned out they were. I mean, that would be a wonderful kind of module for Twitter's editors as a news platform to work in there somehow.
And I'd just like to bring you back in, Benedict. I mean, the report alluded to the idea that men are more likely to tweet their opinions as opposed to women. Have you found this to be true?
No, it was an interesting point you were making. I wonder actually what the gender breakdown of Twitter would be if it actually skews more towards men, in which case you've got a smaller pool of people.
Or are more verified accounts male, for example. That would be important to know.
Yeah, so I mean, it could well be that that's the case. I just had a look at my Twitter feed, and I'm relieved to say that the last person but one I retweeted was a woman, so phew.
Yikes. I'm going to have to start thinking now every time I go to retweet my retweeting.
And I think it's good to perhaps, you know, call yourself up, you know, look at it and actually go, what am I doing, even if that is...
Part of this culture.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You're listening to Fourth Estate, where journalists talk about journalism. I'm Evangeline Maguire, and joining me this week are Tamara Wern from 2GB, Lauren Carroll Harris, freelance journalist who contributes to The Guardian and ABC's Radio National, and Benedict Brook from news.com.au. Now, on Friday evening, White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders was asked to leave the Red Hen restaurant in Virginia, a 26-seat restaurant whose thing is apparently farm-to-table dining. Stephanie Wilkinson, the owner of the restaurant, was called in by a member of the staff and, after taking a staff vote, asked Ms. Sanders to leave mid-cheese platter. Now, while this event created a social media storm over civility and the life of public politicians, on the bright side, Ms. Sanders did score herself a free cheese platter. Apparently in America, this behaviour is common for Trump staffers. It was only on Tuesday that the Secretary of Homeland Security, Kirstjen Nielsen, was at a Mexican restaurant in Washington when she too was heckled by a group of protesters. Benedict, to you first. Do you think it is right to refuse food to someone whom you have ideological and political differences with?
To an extent. I mean, I'm not sure I would have done the same thing. I mean, they are representatives of a democratically elected president that the large, you know, proportion of America voted for. What I found interesting about this was the kind of concept of free speech. I think in Australia it's a bit abstract. You know, we kind of have free speech and we can have free actions, but we don't really use them because we're all too polite to say what we really mean. Whereas in America, they're free speeching it all over the place, you know, up and to the point where I guess it becomes violent, where it becomes they don't do it. So really, they had every right to do this. You know, they had this, the restaurateur had every right to throw Sarah Huckabee Sanders out, and everybody else has every right in America to pile on them from a great height and criticise them, or say they're the most wonderful restaurant ever.
I mean, Tamara, what do you think when you heard this story? Do you think it was the right thing to do?
I think, I mean, it's difficult because the US is very different, as you've said, Benedict, in their concept of free speech than we are in Australia. We don't have a Bill of Rights here as well, like the US does. But for me, it was actually quite terrifying because I thought, well, I think anyone, regardless of their political stance or beliefs, or even further, their sex, their race, their anything, should be refused a commercial service based on that. And that's really, I think, what this comes down to is, yes, a restaurateur did have a right to say no, but where do you draw the line with decisions like that? Because what's awful to one person might not be to another. And in this, it was a protest. They were saying that they didn't agree, the restaurant staff and the owner saying they didn't agree with the inhumane policies of the Trump administration. They have every right to believe that and to disagree with what the government's doing. But I think it's quite different when you're offering a commercial service that's meant to be available to everybody. And I think we'd be talking about this very differently if it wasn't disagreement to the Trump administration. And I think that we've got to be careful at all, because we don't like what someone's policy is. And we might agree with the restaurant owners that we're not actually going down the slippery slope of falling into discriminating against people based on their political beliefs.
I mean, Lauren, the issue dominated the American news cycle over the weekend, and in Australia it was also strongly covered. Do you think this is a big deal?
I actually think it is. I don't think it's about discrimination at all. I think what's happening, I mean, the first hypocrisy that it draws attention to is this faux libertarian stance that Trump has, that, you know, people in America are individuals who have the right to say yes or no to whatever they like. That's the first hypocrisy. But the second is that they're not just refusing service on the basis of political difference. These are, on the one hand, you know, making Trump staffers' lives miserable won't really work. It won't do anything as such. But these are people who are complicit in human rights abuses increasingly, and we're seeing that those abuses are becoming normalised, and that has been one effect that Trump has had in the time that he has been in office, to continually push the public conversation to the right and to try and see what he can get away with. And it actually really surprised me that the Washington Post put out that editorial calling for civility, because I would say the conservatives have always used the language of, you know, honour and politeness and loveliness to cover up what are quite anti, you know, what are very inhumane policies. And now, you know, the centre of politics and the liberal media in the US are really playing into that. And I think that's part of why Trump probably got elected in the first place. I sometimes think there's not as much polarisation and division as we think. In fact, you know, if the liberal media were a bit less patriotic and a bit more critical, they might be able to have a more intelligent counter-response to the madness of Trump.
I mean, it's interesting you say the point about civility, because certainly Trump rallies don't necessarily seem to be very civil places.
And I don't think that the concentration camps that undocumented, that the children of undocumented migrants are very civil places either.
I mean, Tamara, do you think such a thing would occur in Australia, particularly to someone like Malcolm Turnbull's chief of staff?
Well, I mean, we saw Peter Credlin, when she was working with Tony Abbott, copped a lot of flack for his policies and for how she ran his office. So I don't think to the same extent. I mean, I say that, but who knows, really? I mean, someone could decide that they would refuse someone service or to serve someone in a restaurant or any kind of, in a clothing store, any kind of commercial outlet. So I don't think it's impossible that it will happen here, especially the way Australian politics is going, where we are going, like the conservative section of the Liberal Party has a much bigger voice than they have had in the past. And politics in Australia is becoming very individualistic. So we're looking more to individuals rather than parties, and not just the Prime Minister or the Minister for a particular area. We're looking at people who are speaking out, and people who have the same views are gravitating towards them. I mean, Cory Bernardi hasn't had too much success as he's branched out, but he still has a very loyal following on his own. So I don't think it's out of the question that this could happen in Australia, because we are seeing that polarisation a little bit more in our federal politics in particular.
To just follow on that point, do you then think that America is setting almost a tribal standard that one day Australia might adhere to?
Tribal is the new buzzword, I think, for talking about how we like to pull ourselves into groups. And it's something that does happen. We do like to be part of a group. We like to be part of a family. We like to be part of a culture. We like to be part of a country. I mean, in a sense, we are quite nationalistic in Australia, maybe not to the same tone that America is. But we are very different to America, though. I mean, we do receive a lot of their media. We do have a lot of crossover with their politics. We, with our military service, for example, that's very intertwined. But I think we are very different, and we've shown that in the politicians that we elect. I mean, we didn't elect Clive Palmer as president. Like, really, he's one
He'd
of
like
our
us to, with his
he
new
would
adverts.
Love us to. But really, he's almost like our Donald Trump, you know, the eccentric businessman who hasn't really had all that much success in business but thinks that he has. So I think we've still got a little bit of sense with when it comes to colourful characters. In saying that, though, we have just talked about a few people who have managed to get themselves in, and Pauline Hanson is back in Parliament and she's struggling to hold together a party. But yeah, I don't think it's out of the question that we'll have more colourful characters and individuals who are pushing their own agenda in our parliaments. But I think we still are really a two-party country, and a lot of those people haven't really been making their way up the ranks in both our major parties as yet.
Well, Benedict, do you think that maybe it does happen in Australia and it's simply that we just don't care and it doesn't get reported on?
Look, I'm not sure it does. I mean, I think to your point, I do think that Australia has a very different kind of point of view on these things. I think we kind of shirk at some of the excesses that America might have, or at least a stereotype of the excesses that they have. So, I mean, I haven't seen much, you know, examples of anything like this happening, and I'd be surprised.
Lauren, do you think that maybe, I mean, what do you think this says about the type of stories that are saturating the media these days?
Oh, I think this is, you know, when you first hear it, it plays to the typical, you know, the latest outlandish, crazy US politics thing. And we all kind of accept that there's a new low every week. But I actually think there's something different in this story. Like, I didn't know, for example, that, you know, the restaurant workplace took a vote. I thought, whoa, workplace democracy. And I didn't know that this is a widespread kind of occurrence. And that's why I think it isn't just about discrimination. Like, if this kind of became this refusal of service to Trump staffers, Republican members, like, that could be quite a political campaign. It could almost be a form of civil disobedience that could break that stalemate that seems to be there.
But I feel like, in the end of the day, Trump's won this one. You know, yeah. I feel like the fact that I think very cleverly Sarah Huckabee Sanders, when she was asked to leave, left without any great big fuss, so no one could suggest she had caused any issue there. And then I feel like Trump was able to paint the left as intolerant as he is prone to do. So, sure, I mean, they made a very big point by barring them from the restaurant. But, you know, whether or not it's done any good, or whether it's not just bolstered Trump's kind of stereotyping of a group of people who didn't vote for him, I'm not sure.
Mm. Maybe it's a bit bigger than personal civility, and really it's, should businesses have the right to protest on political grounds and refuse patrons? Because is it a form really of political protest that the business is engaging in by refusing members from a certain political party. So maybe that's the bigger question.
I mean, there is that hardware store, I think, in America, which is this week said that in the wake of that vote, that the Supreme Court decision, I think it was about the wedding cake. A hardware store put a sign up saying no gay people allowed because they've been, so that now they're discriminating on what they believe their rights are to not have people in their store. And I think that's worrying.
But maybe it's worrying that we're playing to Trump's tone of conversation. Like, he's not a man who respects the law. Like, he doesn't respect people's rights. So the fact that he is asking for legitimacy is a fake form of legitimacy that I think we have to really question heavily.
It's hard, though, because he is the president of the United States, a democratic country. And do we really – he's got legitimacy because he holds that position. And I'm not saying we should believe or take whatever he says because of that, but he does automatically have that because he's been elected by the people of America to run the country and to make these decisions.
Now, speaking of stories that have been dragged on for far too long, Natalie Joyce has come out of hiding and conducted a tell-all interview with the Australian Woman's Weekly last week. This whole Barnaby, Vicky, Natalie debacle has broken the Australian media and clouded politics for weeks. I'm sure I can speak on behalf of most Australians in asking, is this finally the end of the Barnaby Joyce saga? Benedict, you covered some of the Barnaby saga at news.com.au. What do you think of the Natalie interview? Did you read it?
I had a look at it, and she does say, I think she was referring to her and Barnaby's relationship. We have completed our journey. So perhaps Australia has now completed their journey when it comes to the ins and outs of their crumbling marriage. Look, I thought it was quite classy, really. I thought the way she did that was really good. She's kind of stayed out of the fray whilst he's been kind of busily like imploding all over the place, questioning whether or not he's the father of his newborn son. She's just stayed out of the fray. And then when she decided to have her say, she had clear space to say it. She didn't take any payment from the Australian Women's Weekly. And, you know, I think she did it very, very elegantly and kind of ensured that the public sympathies were on her side and with their daughters.
What are your thoughts on the fact that she didn't take any money? Do you think that that was a statement in itself?
Yeah, I absolutely think it was, because I think it became the money for that Sunday night interview became such a stick to beat Barnaby with that by her taking that payment as well, she would have essentially, I guess, run the risk of seeming to be lowering herself to his level. So she's maintained the high ground, I think.
Mm. Tamara, Barnaby Joyce might not be going anywhere anytime soon, but do you think people still care about this?
I think that people are a bit fatigued with his personal life, hearing about it. It's getting in the way of policies that he's been announcing. He didn't attend the National Party conference a few weekends ago, and I think a lot of people, you know, thought that that would have maybe detracted from what the party was trying to achieve there. I think that, I mean, he's going to recontest at the next election. He says he's not going anywhere. He's always been a colourful character. He's always spoken off the cuff. I don't think this is the last we're going to hear about it. I mean, that little baby Sebastian, I mean, there's going to be, he's been thrust into the spotlight as well. So, you know, I hope that we don't see updates on how little Seb is going throughout his life. I think he's probably had enough. But yeah, I don't think this is the last we're going to hear of it. But I think the public, and I think that the ratings figures on the Sunday night interview showed that as well. I mean, they dropped off and they lost the ratings that night, which should have been the biggest, one of the biggest interviews that they've landed. So I think that there is public fatigue there.
I mean, did you read the interview? Do you have any thoughts on what you thought about what Natalie was saying?
Yeah, I agree with Benedict. I think she was very classy in that. Not taking money is definitely a statement, and she's got the upper hand there. And I think coming out and just telling how she felt and talking about it really, you know, people can connect with that. She wasn't so much casting blame. She was saying, this is what happened according to my experience. This is how it made me feel. And I'm going to be here for my daughters and we just want to move on. And I think that really hit a chord with the public.
In the article, Natalie went into detail about the Channel 7 paid interview and, as a mother of four, talked about the choice of the baby name Sebastian and how it felt like a malicious taunt, because apparently that was a name that she always wanted to call her son. Lauren, do you think her interview was maybe getting a bit too deep into the personal side of the issue and away from the public interest angle?
I don't know if there is a public interest angle anymore. And I read the story and it wasn't the worst thing I ever read. And I totally respect that this woman's trying to reclaim her stake in the narrative. But I don't actually even think it's journalism. I think it's PR for, you know, the slighted side of the Joyce family. And in that respect, I mean, even, what was it, 2 or 3 weeks ago, that Sunday night paid interview with Barnaby, like, we didn't want to see a vile, cheating, lying journalist talk then. And I just don't think, like, I know that editors are probably clamoring for this kind of content, but for every person, every reader who's clamoring for it, there's another reader who's like, this is just so sad and so stupid, and it's not journalism and it's not in the public interest.
But people love a bit of a car crash. You know, they love to read about people's lives imploding. I do think there's fatigue now. I mean, when it first started happening, the whole thing started breaking. You know, there was a very big story for news.com.au readers. It was interesting about the Sunday night figures being as low as they were. But I do think it's got to a point now where every skerrick of that child's
beginning,
has been prodded and poked, and people are just. I look forward to the great cycle of these things, the upcoming rehabilitation of Barnaby Joyce.
No, see, I don't. I think this is just like the only reason it's actually significant is because it probably stands in for this slide of political journalism toward celebrity gossip and entertainment journalism. And that's where it's really worrying, actually.
But he's fueled that as himself. Yeah. I mean, he himself could have stopped talking. I mean,
it's gross. Yeah. It needs to be challenged by journalists, by everyone.
But I think when the story first broke, I think there was definitely public interest there. One, because Barnaby Joyce had so openly spoken about family values and how important they were to voters. And also because of the allegations that taxpayer money had been misused. And I think that was kind of almost glossed over a little bit because of all the sensational affair, younger woman, you know, snaps spread across the paper of a young woman pregnant. And I think that, I mean, both of them deny that. And Vicky Campion, I think there's an investigation going on into her payments and things like that at the moment, and she claims that she's actually owed money out of that. So both of them deny that there was any misappropriation of funds or you know, dodgy jobs being given as favours. But, I mean, to me, I hear that and I think, well, that's definitely of the public interest. Sure. If people are having relationships and, you know, the money that we're paying is being used to help bump them up or move offices. But then we kind of got lost in the messy family drama. And I mean, a lot of Australians go through that. A lot of people around the world go through really awful divorces and there's infidelity. And I think that's why people were interested in it at first, because someone of such a high profile who had spoken out so much about the importance of family values is now, you know, going down the same slide that most people have to go through.
And
so
we do put people, politicians on pedestals, even though we know better and we've seen them all come unstuck. We do look at public figures and think they won't have the same issues in their lives as we do. And they, you know, proves us all wrong.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Lauren, following on from your point about celebrity journalism, she didn't go to Channel 7 or the Daily Telegraph who broke the story, but instead went to the Woman's Weekly. Do you think her choice of publication means anything?
Oh, yeah, I didn't think of it in those terms. I mean, this is a publication that has, you know, people like Marie Bashir on the front cover and stuff like that. I think, yeah, she's trying to go for the respectable middle brow, middle ground. And I think, you know, she's trying to do it in her girl's, her daughter's name and reclaim their name and try and exit this with honour. But I think, you know, she's also fueling it. So I don't know if that will work out for her in the end.
I mean, following on from that, Tamara, do you think that she even needed to speak out? Do you think it might have been better if she just kept silent and the situation just sort of died?
I mean, I think that some of the allegations that were made against you know, her and things that were just left open in that Channel 7 interview, like, you know, Vicky Campion saying, oh, I won't say what she said to me and things like that, are almost worse than us actually finding out what was said in the end. So I understand why she did it. She wanted to get her side on the record. And I think going to the Women's Weekly was a great way to do it because, as we've talked about, you know, everyone was a bit fatigued already. So the audience that will still be interested in that story are the readers of the Women's Weekly. And in that sense, she was able to do it in a magazine format for free. And as she said, I mean, it'll be interesting if she does this and that's it and there's nothing else, then I think, yeah, I think she had a right to reply. But if she then starts speaking out more and more, as we've seen Barnaby doing, then, yeah, that might get a little bit too much.
Benedict, do you think it would have been different if she went to the Daily Telegraph?
I mean, potentially. I mean, you could have gone to the Australian Women's Weekly because you were, I mean, potentially you would have had more control over what was happening in the Women's Weekly. You might be able to craft it a bit better. It may potentially be a softer interview, possibly. And maybe because the Daily Telegraph was so down in the weeds with this story that perhaps you don't want to go there. But it's interesting, the Daily Telegraph. Vicky Campion used to be a reporter there, and there doesn't seem to be any particularly brotherly love towards, she's fair game, really, now.
Now, we couldn't end the show without talking about the latest ABC government saga. Yesterday, the ABC issued out a statement over ABC political reporter Andrew Probyn's report that claimed that Malcolm Turnbull was responsible for the decision to hold 5 federal by-elections on July 28, the same weekend that Labor planned to hold its national conference. The ABC had to issue a statement after being contacted by Senator Mitch Fifield. Now, this comes after a series of attacks on the ABC, and just last week, the Prime Minister criticised the ABC's lack of accuracy and the quality of its journalism. While the ABC labelled their response a clarification and was a mere 4 sentences long, The Australian has since published a lengthy article claiming the ABC was forced to apologise to the Prime Minister. The government complaining about the ABC is nothing new, but it seems to be a very public and topical story at the moment. It seems like the ABC has not given the issue much ground. Lauren, what do you think?
I think that the Turnbull government knows it's really unpopular and they are looking to go, it's looking to go on the offensive, and it's chosen the ABC as, you know, almost an arbitrary target. And the sad thing is that it seems to be working at the moment. You know, I would find it really, this isn't the first complaint that the government has made against the ABC. I think it's made 4 or 5 this year. And I'd be very curious to know if they've made complaints about, you know, other media organisations, or if this is a very targeted attack and an ongoing campaign, because I suspect it is an ongoing campaign. I think what they're trying to do is take control of the public narrative and, almost in the Trump kind of way, try and push that conversation as far as they can so that they can look confident and strong and assertive. But, you know, the worrying thing is that it does seem to be working.
I mean, Benedict, what do you make of the fact that The Australian is claiming that it's an apology, but the ABC is claiming that it's a clarification?
Well, you say tomato, I say tomato, you know. About the complaints they're doing, I feel like Mitch Fifield, you know, first needs to do list, have a cup of coffee, and then write an email to the ABC to complain about something you saw last night. You know, it does seem to be what he does these days. And it's almost like this scattergun approach, that if you complain about enough stuff, some of it's going to stick somewhere. But I mean, like, this is Andrew Probyn, who had this clarification against him. It's the second time this has happened to him. I think it was a report not too long ago where he said Tony Abbott was the most destructive politician of his generation. And, you know, whether or not you agree with that or not, I mean, potentially, if he was going to use that in a cross on the on the news, he probably should have attributed that to somebody. I think if you're an ABC politician, you're aware of the political climate. If you're just doing a straight news story, I think you have to be very careful when you let these things slip in. That may have been a slip up, him not about the by-elections, but it's easy fodder to critics, whether they be the government or the editors of The Australian.
And just to finish up, Tamara, do you think the ABC's response was reasonable?
I think them clarifying was reasonable. I think that, I mean, one of the things with political reporting in such short spaces like TV, get around, what, a minute 20 to explain complex political stories and contextualise them as well for the listeners and for the audience. And some of that information needs to be opinion, but it does need to be attributed to where that's come from. I don't think it's up to journalists to tell people those kind of comments or say that a politician is destructive or attribute that to a politician unless it's come from somewhere else. I think that's something that I think that the ABC did a good job in clarifying it that way. I mean, there's always been a bit of conflict and friction between The Australian and the ABC, so I'm not surprised that The Australian is calling it an apology. That's, you know, that's part and parcel of their relationship. But I think political journalists, especially working to high standards like the ABC, and Proben has come from a commercial organisation beforehand, so that probably would have been okay where he was working beforehand and that would have gone through. And now the ABC does have higher standards, and so it should. I think that we need to be very careful when we're mixing opinion with political reporting.
But I think this definitely isn't just about, you know, one or two complaints, is it? It's part of a more generalised undermining that the government is trying to make of, you know, trying to imply that the ABC is impartial, that it doesn't stand for taxpayers, that it's misusing taxpayers' money, that it's bloated and fat and incorrect and left-wing and lazy. So I think it's important to contextualise and position, you know, just this recent news story within that kind of.
But who are they? The thing is, it just seems such a worthless thing to do, because they're, I mean, sure, people who are rusted on Liberal voters get very excited about potential bias at the ABC, but nobody else does. I think there was a report, some stats out today that showed people that the ABC is the most trusted media brand in the country or something.
More than Facebook, for example.
Well, way more than Facebook, yeah. So it feels like, you know, if they're trying to move the dial and make sure they stay in power, I'm not sure. It just seems odd that they should be going at the ABC to the degree that they seem to be.
And I think if we separate the government's response to what happened, I know they were the ones that complained and raised the issue. I think that we should be holding a national broadcaster to a high account, just as we should be holding all journalists to a high account. But where it gets messy is when you're looking at the repeated complaints that are made against the government, against one organisation, and that's an imbalance. But I do think that the ABC did the right thing here in clarifying, but it still doesn't mean that the government has been lodging too many complaints against one organisation.
Well, that's it from us on Fourth Estate. Thank you to my guests Tamara Wern, Lauren Carroll Harris and Benedict Brooke. Next week, Peter Frey will be back in the host seat. Make sure you're subscribed to Fourth Estate on your favourite podcast app so you can hear us talk media, politics and a few things in between. We'll be back in the studio for more next week, but in the meantime, you can stay in touch with us on Facebook or Twitter. Our handle is Fourth Estate AU. I'm Evangeline Maguire. Thank you for listening. We'll be right back.